Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bomb Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel and Jumper and Comics Dungeon. Welcome to 2017, y'all. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Nicole Hornaday.
2017.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Class of 2017.
2017.
Just throw it out. I couldn't continue.
Whoa.
All right. Whoa. Hey, how's everybody doing?
All right. Assuming I'm alive in the future.
Yes.
It's a fresh new year.
It is a fresh new year, and with that, we can make of it as we please. And so, moving on from that, let's
just squish it like Play-Doh between our fingers.
Let's just dive right into the topic today. And previously, we talked about the late Steve Dillon, and how he was so adept at facial expressions. So I want to know what other artists are really great at like subtlety and nuance when it comes to. Well, let's start off with facial expressions.
I didn't see subtlety or nuance in here at all.
I just made up nuance.
The one artist that always stood out to me as being really super adept at realistic and vivid facial expressions was Kevin Maguire. Mm-hmm. And he's really not on the grid anymore, but he had a really lengthy run in the 80s on Justice League, written by J.M. DeMatteis. And Keith Giffen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very irreverent, silly, satirical time for that comic book. And it was actually quite offensive to a lot of people because it really was, there was a lot of action, there were some cool villains, interesting stories, but it was heavy duty on the humor and the slapstick, down to punch-ups between Guy Gardner and Batman. And that's when we Yeah, one punch. I can't believe you knocked him out with one punch. So I love that comic, and I love that man's artwork so much. I turned his panels into an acting class exercise. And this is back when I was in graduate school. And I photocopied a bunch of the pages, and one of them was the sequence where Batman knocks guy out with one punch. And I said, okay, we're going to do some audio theater. And I said to the students, take a look at the facial expressions in these comics and let that inform how you deliver the dialogue. So we just sat, I had everybody sit in a circle with their backs to everyone and do the dialogue, but based on the expressions that they got, how that informed the impressions they got from the images. And it was really kind of a fun exercise. Hmm. But yeah, it was a bit, little bit loopy. But hey, I was in graduate school in the 90s, all right? So yeah, love that guy's artwork.
All right. Anybody else?
Yeah,
we're both on this one.
Okay. Yeah, so Juanjo Guarnido from Black Sad. So he was an illustrator who worked on the Disney Tarzan movie and a couple other projects for them, I think. But he has some of the most amazing facial expressions. The entire book is anthropomorphic. All the characters are animals. And so he utilizes the species of the animal to highlight the characteristics of the person. But then on top of that, just utterly amazing facial expressions. He actually also did a cartoon for like a Swedish death metal band. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of great facial expressions in that cartoon. Another favorite one for me is Carla Speed McNeil, who does Finder.
And No Mercy.
And you could take out all the dialogue in those books and just read the facial expressions and the body movements and get a lot of the story from that alone.
Yeah.
So she's one of my favorites.
I would say in the No Mercy series, because I only read a tiny bit of Finder. The No Mercy is kind of like a character-driven horror in a way. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is based on the people, and that's the story. So the emotiveness of the art makes a huge difference in that series.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I'm also a fan of Derek Robertson, who is the artist of The Boys. He's currently doing Harbinger for Valiant. He does a lot of great facial expressions too. He's another go-to guy that Garth Ennis utilizes, like Garth Ennis utilized Steve Dillon.
Right.
He's a little bit dirtier and grittier in some of his artwork, but he can really get across a lot of the characters' emotions like through their eyes alone. So, Mm-hmm.
All righty. Is there anybody? Let's continue on this artwork thread, mm-hmm. and let's talk about not just the human emotion, but of other aspects of comic book artistry. Is there anybody out there who is like really good at drawing architecture? Because I read, I think it was. It was Lock and Key,
yes.
and
Gabriel Rodriguez.
Gabriel Rodriguez. The buildings in that book were amazing.
He also did a Little Nemo comic for IDW, and the huge castles are utterly beautiful to see. There's like double page spreads with like these giant maps and everything. Fantastic work. For architecture, him and Brian Talbot. Mm-hmm. Who did Heart of the Empire and quite a few other
Tale of One Bad Rat.
Tale of One Bad Rat.
All the Luther Arkwright books. Yeah, he does fascinating work. It may be too much of a trial to endure, but after about 100 issues into Cerebus the Aardvark, Dave Sim hired this gentleman named Gerard, artist just went by one name, to just do the architecture and the backgrounds and the interiors for the comic book. And he really soared in these designs. And Sim was always an accomplished self-taught artist in his own right, and very adept at facial expressions and things like that, in this cartoony style. But Gerard brought this whole level of style and panache to the Cerebus comic book, and there are issues where it's not just architecture. There are planetoids and asteroids and forests, and the detail is exquisite. It's black and white, so you can appreciate it that much more.
That's interesting because I hadn't thought about that before, but in traditional animation, like for a weekly cartoon series, there is a whole team that is only on backgrounds.
That's right.
Yeah, and a different team works on the foreground characters.
That doesn't happen a lot, but when Gene Ha started doing Top 10 with Alan Moore, he signed on Xander Cannon, who now does Kaiju Max. Mm-hmm. But Xander and Gene started working together, and Xander was just doing the backgrounds, just doing the cityscapes, just doing the interiors, and Gene was doing the character designs. Mm-hmm. And they were a terrific, terrific pair.
Yeah, and another artist and creator is the guy who did Planetoid, Ken Gehring. While his humans weren't necessarily the strongest, the landscaping and creating the world was just phenomenal in that.
Yeah, it's always funny to me when there's creators who are great at a lot of those aspects, except for the humans. That happens in a lot of the Transformer comics. There's Alex Milne does fantastic, fantastic mecha robot stuff. And then you get to the human, sometimes you're like, that nose is a little wonky.
Well, like with the Animal Man, New 52 Animal Man with Travel Foreman.
Oh, yeah, beautiful monsters.
His monsters were fantastic. His people were atrocious.
Yeah, well, and he's the guy doing Ultimates now.
Worst,
And yeah, that's the thing. You look at the humans, you're just like, if they're not the worst, they're boring. But then a cool-looking cosmic entity shows up, and you're like, there you go.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about Jeff Darrow.
Yeah.
I mean, Jeff Darrow is all about detail, this incredible detail. The hard-boiled comic book, which is nothing but, you know, how many pages was it? Five? You know, but these exhaustive illustrations, you know, and Frank Miller wrote five lines of dialogue for the four-part comic book. But just like down to the multitude of cigarette butts on the sidewalk and these shell casings that are piled up in the, you know, around the character's feet. The detail in that book is just amazing between the architecture and the costumes and things.
And Juan Jose Rip is of the same cloth.
I love Rip,
beautifully detailed. You could definitely tell he took it from Jeff Darrow and just kind of added his own little twist to it.
People aren't the most emotive, but his detail work, and he does the like pointillism sort of a little bit in there, and that's really good.
Now, the meeting point for me between those kind of styles, the hyper detail, but also simplicity that can get like a lot of facial expressions and stuff down, is Jason Burroughs, who did Providence. So I've been looking at his art nonstop for the past couple of weeks. And somebody was telling me they just thought that he was boring at first. When you look at it, he's very clean. It's kind of like when you're looking at Dave Gibbons from Watchmen. But then you start seeing the actual construction that he's doing, and then you look at the facial expressions happening, and that's something else Dave Gibbons has a strength for, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask if you would have Jason Burroughs on there for that, because his work is really solid.
Really solid, clean and simple, but then something horrible arrives, some tentacle monster, and the detail gets ratcheted up like crazy.
Yeah.
Something else, though, is action sequences. There's some people who cannot draw action to save their lives.
Yep.
And then there's some people that are born to it, like Jack Kirby, who's very bombastic. But one of my favorites is Yukito Kishiro, who did Battle Angel Alita. And just the most kinetic work you'll ever see. And these
is it eye-popping?
It's very eye-popping, literally, many times. And
gross.
Yeah. And he'll spend like so much time just creating this one fight sequence that lasts for an entire book.
Right.
And like all these movements are mapped out, choreographed, and everything. And it's beautiful. So, yeah.
Cool. Is there anybody out there? I think we've probably talked about this before, but let's revisit it. Is there any artist out there who's just good at everything? You've never seen them do a bad panel.
Yeah, I mean, the One hole
Garnito. Yeah,
I mean,
the
stuff
black
is
side.
Just solid.
Yeah, it's solid
it's
all the way through.
It's just absolutely gorgeous.
I've been looking at a lot of the EC artists from the 50s, you know, and these are the artists that inspired a lot of our contemporary artists. And but, you know, I've been looking at, like, Wally Wood's stuff and Jack Davis and because these are the gentlemen that were, you know, they came from a school of illustration and not a school of comic books, and they developed a lot of this stuff predates Marvel Comics by a couple of decades. And one of the things I look to is the completeness of the vision of reality that an artist is dealing with. And Wally Wood in particular, you know, his ships in all of his different comic strips all look like they were manufactured at the same place. And his spacesuits and the planets and the critters on them, they were in a complete universe. And that's something that always kind of thrills me. Doesn't look like anybody else's. In the case of those gentlemen, that's because they had no predecessors in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Basil Wolverton,
his
sci-fi stuff.
Oh, that's just so weird
absolutely
and surreal.
Gorgeous,
yeah.
Too. I mean, he just did some amazing illustration work.
Yep. Yeah. I agree.
For a modern creator, I'd say Chris Samnee.
Oh, yeah.
Who's currently doing the Black Widow comics.
Mm-hmm.
He's a true draftsman who can do the stuff like emotion, do the weaponry, the cars, the everything, the body movement, the action. And he's definitely learned from the schools of, like, a little bit of Wally Wood, a little bit of Ditko, a lot of Alex Toth.
Mm.
And Alex Toth is if you ever wanted to see the perfect example of less is more, that's the person you want to look up. So Samnee's kind of that high level for me right now. And his run on Daredevil is amazing. He did a run of Thor with Roger Langridge, which is to this day one of my favorite comics.
Mm.
So, and Marvel murdered it for some reason. So.
How about Cassidy?
John Cassidy. Yeah, I just wish he could actually produce regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there was his work on Planetary and the Joss Whedon, the Astounding X-Men stuff is just beautiful.
Cassidy's one of the few people I have original artwork of.
Right.
One of the few people I was willing to hunt down. Mm-hmm. So.
All right. Anything else about artwork before we move on?
Yeah, I have a few more things. Back to, like, landscaping and things like that. The Kurosagi Corpse Delivery Service, the artist Husu Yamazaki. Absolutely gorgeous. Almost like a black and white picture of something. That is really gorgeous. And then on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, I love Stucco's, like, monsters. He did the Half Century War. He also did that Sullivan Sluggers. Just like weird globular almost.
Yeah.
Those kind of monsters or something.
That's one of our favorite words.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Globular.
Well, you know, Corbin, another Corbin thing came out.
Yeah.
Right. That did just come out, didn't it?
Corbin's The Shadows of the Something of the Mansion of the Blood of the Something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But published by Dark Horse.
Yeah, that's right.
And then as far as just like adding like little details and fun things to look at, I always like Brendan Graham, just because, especially with his color work, he just makes little creatures in the back have their own characters and stuff. Mm-hmm. It just makes it really exciting for the world that he makes.
Cool.
All right. Great. Well, that's art and artwork, subtlety, nuance, and photorealism, apparently.
Well, Robert Crumb, if you want very healthy, large women.
And if you're just joining us this year, if your New Year's resolution was to listen to more local Seattle independent podcasts, check out our episode on Robert Crumb. From a couple of weeks ago, where we talked to the gentleman from
Fantagraphics.
From Fantagraphics, yeah.
Who just had their 40th anniversary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on, y'all, and seeing as how it is the first episode of 2017. I'm still writing 2016 on my checks. Let's talk about what, and I said that same joke last year, what are our hopes for 2017. What do we want to see? We revisited what our hopes were in our last episode during quiz time. But so let's talk about it again. What do we want to have happen in 2017? What do we think will happen? What do we think might not happen? Who wants to start?
I don't want to think about what might actually happen. I just want to be hopeful.
Let's be optimistic then.
Yeah.
Everybody has thoughtful expressions.
Oh, go ahead.
I want to see more of what I saw in 2016 that made me happy.
Yeah.
And that and a great deal of that was the diversity. More stories by and about people of color, and I'm speaking primarily with superheroes because superheroes is my jam. But more stories by and about characters of color, LGBT characters. Characters from different perspectives, because as you may recall, if you've listened to the last 100 plus episodes, I am so bored with the angst of white male privileged superhero stories that it's, I don't think I realized that that's why I was getting out of comic books until the beautiful and talented Ben Lawrence came into
pulled
my life.
Pulled you back in.
Pulled me back in. But now, I was at a party last week, and someone said, "Well, Cole, what comic books are you reading?" And I actually pulled out my bag of purchases from Comics Dungeon from a few hours before, and I found myself holding up comics, going, "Well, this one's about a plus size superhero. This one's about a fictitious African nation. This one is about." A Muslim superhero, this one's an Korean American Hulk, and a female Thor, and I realized that there was not one book that I had in that stack. It was about a cisgendered, privileged male character, and I'm like, wow. Oh, and the Flintstones. Wow, and that is really cool, and I want more of that.
Okay,
so that's one of the things I want from 2017. But I'll let other people talk.
I recently saw some evidence that the Battle Angel Alita movie will happen in 2018, so I just need to survive 2017.
Oh my God, 2018 is going to be our year then, because I got so, Black yeah. Panther.
Well, like, there's full casting, too, and the guy who played Ajax from Ooh. Deadpool is one of the bad guys, and I'm just like, wait, you casted somebody? You're getting closer. It's happening. It's interesting, too, Latina girl as Alita. So Robert Rodriguez is doing this, so it's going to be very interesting. Hmm. I think it's a 2018. If it's 2017, I just need to see that. That's my hope, that Battle Angel does not suck.
And it is Robert Rodriguez doing it?
Robert Rodriguez doing it. Right. James Cameron has relinquished complete control. He's just kind of producing it now.
Cool.
So that means it can actually happen now.
All right.
Well, that means he can focus more of his energy on Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
I'll believe it when I see it.
No.
No.
All right. Nicole, do you have any wishes for 2017?
Chris and I have a very special time coming up, and that is the release of the Lego Batman movie.
Yes.
Nice. That we will see together.
Yes.
As friends, because friendship is magic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My little Batman. It'd be like my little Joker, really, because Joker's so heartbroken in that movie. So my hope is that there's a lot more teamwork in superhero comics in 2017, and we stop fighting each other. That Marvel stops putting out number ones and just sticks to having quality content, because they have a lot of good stuff. and that DC rebuilds themselves a bit more in 2017 and starts to gain back some confidences, maybe work out more of the kinks that they have going on. And the announcement that, you know, the Galactus character can be released into the, you know, the universe, Marvel Studios can get them back, and there's going to be some, you know, Galactus showing up in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy 3 in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
That's never going to happen, but I just have to throw something out there.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to piggyback on your thing, Cole, mm-hmm. that we not only see continued diversity in the superheroes, but we also see it in the creative teams.
Mm-hmm.
World of Wakanda is part
Absolutely.
Of that. And I would love to see more of that. I mm-hmm. want to see some, like, I want to see that Marvel swimsuit special edition from Chris Anka and Kevin Wada in 2017. That can be the beginning of a beautiful diversity rainbow.
I just read the latest issue of Faith, and one of the things I did that would be issue 6, and I'm not going to review it, but I just wanted to mention that it was an aspect about it that I liked, and that was the conflict was resolved at the conclusion of the story without violence. And that's one of the things that's good about the book, is that very seldom are their fists lifted, very, very seldom are their punch-ups. And I'm done with punch-ups because they're boring, and violence is boring.
And look at Squirrel Girl. She resolves things in so many creative, Absolutely. Wonderful ways. And we get to learn in the process.
Right. And yeah. I'm curious. I don't know if I'm supportive of it, but Chris... the article you posted about
the new sincerity.
The new sincerity.
Yeah.
Sincerity's always been kind of an iffy word for me, but mm-hmm. I read the article and I'm like, oh, these are all really, really good points, that sincerity or kindness maybe will be the backlash
mm-hmm.
to all this. And this new generation of creators and thinkers will think this way. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I can totally get behind this.
Yeah.
Because my generation are the grim and gritty, punch them hard, punch them harder. No, we need rocket launchers for that, and rail guns. And more than anything else, it's boring. It's tedious.
I mean, I think it has its place, but having an option to opt out of it is great.
Yeah, yeah.
For an actual hope, not a movie hope, I will throw in that I do hope that Marvel and DC will... I don't know, create an imprint that is more kid-friendly.
Oh, yes.
And I mean, like, a lot of their stuff is okay for younger readers, but I actually, because if you look at some of the stuff that Scholastic's putting out, or DC licenses some of their stuff, like the Superhero Girl stuff, it's like more of that. The DC Super Pets is some of our best-selling stuff for you know, really young readers.
Tiny Titans.
But there is no Tiny Titans right now.
No.
And everything that they're kind of putting out that would be considered that thing, it feels like a like they're just trying to shut us up. You know, like there's a super-powered comic coming out right now by the creators of Tiny Titans.
Right.
It feels a little forced, and it's only a 6-issue miniseries, so it's just kind of like, here's the thing, shut up, we did it.
Yeah.
I want an actual, like, no. Make it a point to not only produce this stuff, but, like, work with libraries across the nation and schools, get it in there, have it so that the kids see this, grow up with it.
Yep.
Because they've tried things before, and where they fail is marketing. Mm-hmm. They tried young teen reader stuff before, and they just never actually advertised it. So the only people receiving it were comic stores full of 30-year-old white men.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, you know, try a little harder. So just that, I'd like to see a little bit more of that.
I would mm-hmm. love to see mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else before we move on?
That's plenty.
That is plenty.
If we can even do some of that, I think we'll be good.
And I will ask you about this come next December, 2017.
I will be freaking out because I'll be like 2 months away from Black Panther.
All right. My hope for the next year is that we are still doing this little show.
Just keep it real, real status quo for 2017. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Keep on keeping on, as I like to say. All right, let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Cole Hornaday, let's start off with you, sir.
Sure. Well, this week I'm reviewing We Stand on Guard by Brian K. Vaughan and Steve. I always pronounce it Scroce. scrotchy.
Sounds like a dirty word.
Kind of looks scrotchy now,
it's
but
only dirty because you made it so.
I thought it was scrosy.
Scrosy. That's
but
more
I have
viable.
No basis on reality.
This is an image. I'm referring to the hardbound edition, which is a compilation of six issues. It's a mini series set in the 21st century, 22nd century rather, 2112.
Yes.
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 That'd be the 22nd century.
Yes.
Where America is at war with Canada immediately following a supposed terrorist attack of the Canadians on the White House. And what we ultimately learn is that it's America wants Canada's fresh water, and they will stop it at nothing to get it. So the Canadians, in the Americans' eyes, the Canadian protagonists are essentially terrorists or freedom fighters, basically the Mujahideen. I thought this was a brilliant series, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it. I just want to give you a cursory reason why I think it's a valuable book, particularly now, is that you know, every once in a while, I think it behooves us as Americans to stop and go, to stop and ask, why do they hate us? What did we do?
They hate us because they ain't us. Sorry.
You just totally shut me down, buddy.
Different tones,
this
man.
This is one of those stories where I did not see this book as a thought question. I saw this book as a distinct possibility because, you know, one of the things that one of the resources that we will be fighting over in the future will be water. And that's what this story is about. And it's about the Canadians trying to maintain their rights as a nation, as a community, and that which was theirs. And I think a lot of people were kind of snickering over this story. Oh, going to war with the Canadians. They've always been our friends. And I'm like, well, your friends cease to be your friends when they have something that you need.
It's not so much a future dystopia, too, because certain aspects of that are happening to this day.
That's right.
Oh,
that's
right.
I highly recommend this book. I highly recommend it because the Americans are not the good guys. The Canadians are the good guys. I highly recommend it because I think it's... I think it's reflective of the world to come, and it's also a vision of who we are that we don't pay a lot of attention to. And I think in the coming regime, it will behoove us to pay more attention to these kinds of stories and where we came from and who we are, because America has always been great. America has always been great. America has always been great. And don't you believe it when anybody ever tells you they're not. But we're great for a lot of really good reasons, but we're also powerful for a lot of bad reasons. I recommend this book.
We stand on guard.
For president.
We stand on guard.
From Image.
From Image.
By Image.
Brian,
all right.
Come on.
Chris Casso, what do you got?
So I read Inhumans versus X-Men number 0, and this is the current event. And interesting thing to note is that I believe each issue will have a different artist.
At least it seems that way because Rockefeller was on the first one. Now he's just doing covers.
Yeah, and because the next one, I think, is Lionel Francis Yu. So we spoke about it in a previous episode. The Inhuman Terrigen Mist is flying around the world in a giant cloud, transforming people. If it touches a mutant, they die horribly get sick, kind of.
Yeah.
And so there was a previous short story, The Death of X, which finally explained how Cyclops died. And spoilers, it's not... I could go ahead, right?
I think so, because Death of X goes right into Inhumans versus X-Men.
Basically, Cyclops died on the first page of Death of X. He died of the cloud immediately, mm-hmm. but... Emma Frost, the White Queen, created a hallucination in everyone's mind that he actually did not die and that he declared war on Inhumans because she wanted the idea of Scott Summers to continue on to be a revolutionary concept. So after those events, Beast joined the Inhumans to see if he could make a cure to prevent this from being an issue. And this issue follows that timeline where, over the course of 8 months, no, he could not. And the Inhumans are kind of like, well, that sucks. We got to prepare for the mutants to be mad at us and be ready to kill them, essentially. And Emma Frost in the background is getting things ready for that war.
Yeah.
Because she does not trust the Inhumans.
And I think she just really wants war.
Yeah,
she seems to be pretty into the whole...
Well, she's a villain. She's always been a villain. But she's a villain that has loves and cares and, like, I am a mutant and we're almost dead, so I'm joining the X-Men. It's great artwork. It's Roquefort. It's Charles Soule doing the story. It's a good setup. There's a sequence where I think both Nicole and I were like, what is actually being told to us in that? Which is when Beast is realizing he can't cure everything, he's beginning to overhear the Inhumans that they're kind of getting kind of cagey. And there's a panel that shows the inside of Beast's brain. And it looks like a summary of all the horrible things that have happened in the past 10 years.
Yeah.
And to me, that read like him being like, oh, Scott was right this entire time. So I have to read number one, which came out 2 weeks ago in podcast time.
Yeah.
Because I think it's actually Beast getting the X-Men together and being like, hey, guys.
Well, and he also overhears something with the Inhumans that I think helps to motivate him.
Yeah.
Because in the meantime, he'd been pretty neutral. Like, we can all work together and we can figure this out with science.
Well, and he hates Scott, so he was instantly, like, anti-Scott during Death of X and everything. So it's interesting. It's well put together.
Yeah.
I'll have to read the next issue and hope they maintain that. I think this will be the springboard to relaunch the X-Men and also relaunch the Inhumans one more time to see if it sticks. And I'm kind of hoping by the end of it, we do get old Scott back somehow.
We only have two core team X-Men books on the stands, right?
Extraordinary and Uncanny.
And I read Extraordinary, which is the teens.
Yeah. And three titles. All New X-Men is the teens.
All New.
I read All New X-Men.
Yes.
Do I read Extraordinary too?
Extraordinary is like Storm, Colossus.
No, I do not.
Nightcrawler.
No, I read the one with the teens in the TARDIS Airstream trailer.
Yep. All New X-Men.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. What?
Okay.
That's ridiculous.
So once upon a time there was 16. I'm not exaggerating.
Nope.
There were 16 X-Men titles and on the stands, and then they filtered down and you made it sound like I thought you said Extraordinary was going away.
I'm gonna guess they're almost all gonna go away.
I think
it'll be a full relaunch.
Okay.
Fresh.
And they're going back to the 90s because that's apparently the only thing they like to go back to. And they're gonna do X-Men Gold, X-Men Blue.
Oh, geez.
And then they're gonna do Generation X, and they're gonna do Cable, and they're gonna do.
So when you say going back to the 90s, we are resetting the stories from the 90s forward?
I don't know.
Oh,
we'll
don't do that to me.
We'll have to wait and see because we know just about as much as y'all do.
2017 is going to be an interesting year.
It really is.
Not if we're going back to 1992. It's not.
we're going to party like it's 1999. Nicole, what did you read this week?
I've decided to change my book last minute.
That's not allowed.
What?
But the bylaws of the Brooklyn Bound Podcast.
Are you breaking the law? Breaking the law.
Judas
breaking
Priest
the law.
Breaking the law.
Ah.
That's why
she's my bestie.
Well, it's also a bit controversial because I tend to not go for stuff that's like really good sellers in the store because they sell really well.
Right.
But I wanted to make mention of Paper Girls Volume 1. You're doing Brian K. Vaughan. Mm-hmm. But two, because a lot of customers didn't know this fun fact. Mm-hmm. And that in Paper Girls, so I'll give you the premise first and then fun fact. Paper Girls is drawn by Cliff Chiang, gorgeous artwork, written by Brian K. Vaughan, and it's these paper girls on their paper route in the 1980s, and they come across some weird alien ninja guys and find out that, like, people are starting to disappear, and then there's, like, saga-like people showing up, and they're, like, the elders, and they're, like, sort of at war with these, like, teenage ninja zombie guys.
I hear nothing but great things about this book, and I've never read it.
It's very fun, but the alien people have some interesting tech. They also have like Apple software and stuff, and like they go back and they like rummage through technology and like use it for things, and they have these big warehouses and stuff. But what's interesting is they have their own language, and Brian K. Vaughan made an alphabet, an alien alphabet, and you can actually decode it. A lot of people didn't know that you can read what the people are saying to each other, and you get more of the story because some of the ninja zombie tech people, they're not really zombies, but they look kind of deformed. There's actually like a gay relationship in there. One of them dies and they're heartbroken, and they're trying to save some of the girls and stuff like that. And getting more of that story is very compelling. And there's a WordPress site that's the dinglehopper.wordpress.com, and they do an English decoder ring from the cyborg Chrononaut. And so you can find the full language, and the language starts to be decoded each issue, and so you get more and more of the alphabet. And then if you want to just be lazy, which is totally acceptable, you can scroll down to the bottom and it will just fill in all of the word bubbles from the pages that have the alien technology. And so I read the story and I thought it was really solid. Again, like, it being really solid isn't always necessarily the most compelling thing to keep me reading, but the extra added bonus of having this language and having like, oh, what's going on with this culture and like all these different aspects of it that he's brought in just with that language alone has made it far more interesting for me. I found myself scouring over the pages and learning the letters myself. So now I see something and I'm like, oh, that's a W. Oh, that's a Y. You know, like, oh, it must be this. And that's been really fun for me. It gives me a little bit more depth to a story that's somewhat like, not necessarily linear, but a little bit like less deep than some other. It's no Providence for one. Yeah. But what is?
What I will say is that you gave one of the best plot breakdowns of that book that I've ever heard, because I never try. I think that book is nearly impossible to define. It's because it just keeps throwing weird stuff and doesn't explain it. It has that lost element. So the only way I ever try to describe it is that it's Stranger Things by way of Lost and Night of the Comet shoved through the Terminator. That's the only way I can define it.
Yeah.
I like all those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fun. I love period pieces in the 80s. That's a period piece now.
I'm just trying to imagine something shoved through the Terminator. I'm sorry. Go on.
A lot of, like, yeah. I mean, they're robots, man.
Robots. Yeah.
But it's a really fun series, and I find that that element is really fun, and I like the Dingle Hopper for making that content available and giving it something, you know, like a fun adventure kind of hunt to go on. And I'm usually really lazy, but something about Dakota Rings, I was totally there. So
excellent.
I thought that was the hype train you should get on. I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my friend Andrew Lee Creech asked me a couple of weeks ago, have I been reading the book? I'm like, no. Have you guys reviewed it on the podcast? No, I don't think so. He's like, well, you guys need to get down with that. So, Andrew, it happened.
There you go.
Yes.
There's a, I saw like tech, footage of possible tech, and it's this AR app, an augmented reality app. It's a language translator, so you hold your phone up to a sign like in an airport. It says, you know, east and west or whatever in a language you don't understand, but it'll translate it to English or whatever language you
want.
Cool. You can only imagine that happening for this comic, for you holding your phone up, but it's not quite complete, you know, because the whole thing has been decoded. So you hold it over the panel, and it's somewhat, it's like garbled, but you can kind of get to it. So
that would be a cool extra bonus to the comic.
It's got
to
be
could do something like that
in the pipeline, man.
But
it's got to be.
There is actually a translator in the comic where if you wear this certain thing, you can understand the aliens. So for a small section of the first volume, you can hear what they're saying.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Nicole. And that is Book Report, and that is our show. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Horn today and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Find us online at perfectboundpodcast.com, where you can subscribe via iTunes or any way you get your podcasts. And send us an email, perfectboundpodcast
thebookreportpodcast@gmail.com. And now, everybody, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time, and this week these questions are coming to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Well, the theme, the subject of the quiz time this week is, as one of my dear friend Ben Lawrence's favorite subjects.
Oh, dear God.
Sports.
Puppets.
Oh.
Yeah. Sport puppets.
He loves puppets. So the title of this one is puppets. Nothing Up My Sleeve or Puppet Pals from Panel to Panel.
That's his Kermit the Frog person.
This artisan is the stepfather of blind sculptress Alicia Masters and a longtime nemesis of the Fantastic Four, known for controlling the minds and bodies of his victims by sculpting their likenesses in radioactive clay. Chris.
The Puppet Master.
That's right. Philip Masters, a.k.a. the Puppet Master, first appeared in Marvel's Fantastic Four number 8 in 1962. Next up, this unique villain, known for his wooden performances...
Oh, jeez.
And an annoying speech impediment rose to prominence as one of Gotham City's most quirky underworld figures. And yes, figures is in quotes.
I'm coming for you, Gatman!
Scarface.
That's right, Scarface. Oh, wow. And Arnold Wesker, a.k.a. the Ventriloquist, first appeared in Detective Comics number 583 in February of 1988.
583.
This very literary-minded villain from the now cherished and highly influential Fox Saturdays animated series The Tick was the right-hand man, quite literally, to the mentally challenged villain the Human Ton.
It's not talkie.
I don't know. Cole is waving his hand at me.
I'm waving my hand.
Handy
Puppet first appeared.
Wow.
First appeared in the Tick episode, The Tick versus Arthur's Bank Account, airing in February of 1992, and is fond of making literary references,
like Achilles in his tent,
that go over the heads of his villainous colleagues, inspiring him to frequently declare one of my favorite quotes of the entire series,
read a book!
So
it's an homage! Like Achilles in his tent!
Anyway, he was the first... They're all laughing at home hysterically. Yeah.
Or in the car.
He was one of the first fables to escape his realm in the homelands and take up exile in Fabletown, the invisible villa located right under the noses of the Mundys of New York City. In addition, this character has a direct relation to the adversary, a plot point I will not ruin if you've not read the entire Bill Willingham series Fables. Anybody?
Pinocchio.
Pinocchio first appeared in Fables number 4, published by Vertigo in 2002. This, next up, lastly, finally, this beloved British TV series created by Gerry Anderson featured a cast made entirely of puppets performed through Super Marionation, who raced across the globe as part of Rescue International, a secret organization dedicated to preserving all human life. Mr. Lawrence.
Thunderbirds are go!
Produced in the UK and distributed through ITC Entertainment, the series ran in syndication from 1964 to 1966 and featured all manner of mind-blowing aircraft with nary a flesh-and-blood performer in sight.
All right.
And that is quiz.
Awesome. Yay. Thank you, Cole. Mm-hmm. And thank you all for a lovely inaugural episode of 2017. As Cole mentioned earlier, he said something like the past hundreds or so episodes. This is episode 99 that we are on. Next week is episode 100, and tune in. You don't want to miss it. But until then, we will see you next week.